Hey, y'all, I'm John Shires, and I'm an alcoholic. I thought we were going fishing, too. Before I start, I try to be selfless and humble and thank some people, because I'm not selfless and humble. But I want to thank Jerry and Jeanette, you know, for all their hospitality, and James for looking after me, and all the people that I've met. It's hard to be the Sunday morning speaker at one of these deals. It's much easier to be Friday night, you know. For selfish reasons, totally self-centered reasons, and I'll explain that. When you're a Sunday morning speaker, they call that the spiritual speaker. And it's not just because it's Sunday morning. It's because you really have to be spiritual all weekend. Because if you're the Friday night speaker, that's the best deal ever. And we had a killer Friday night speaker. She set the bar way up here. Just so high, you know. But when you're Friday night speaker, you get it out of the way. Now you can enjoy yourself. And plus, everybody knows you, and they're going to come up and tell you how great you are. You know, I mean, even if you stunk the joint up, they'd tell you that because, you know, that's how we are in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you just did great. You know, but Tracy knocked it out of the park. No commentary on Tracy's talk. But when you're the Sunday morning speaker, you got to stick your hand out to folks and you got to say hi and whatever. And especially if you're having your meals, which you often are, with the people who've already spoke, because everybody knows them, they want to talk to them. And you're all, poor me, I'm the Sunday. So you got to really be spiritual, you know. So that's why it's a spiritual deal. But Tracy started it off really strong, and then where's Sissy? She's over here somewhere, and Sissy just did a bang up job. And I heard your talk a couple of times, and I cried again. So kind of a manly crying, like kind of, you know. And then that unity workshop was really good and really important. Our unity is a really critically important thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then, man, last night Rick just took it even higher and maybe the best opening line of any AA talk I've ever heard. Just awesome. I'm never going to forget that, ever. I've driven farther for a hooker than to do this talk, you know. I've done the same thing. I don't know. God's in charge as much as I can get out of the way and let him be in charge, so that's what you're going to get. So whatever you think, take it up with your higher power. Because I've done everything in my power this morning. I've hit my knees. I've said, God, help me get out of the way and just tell the truth about me. And I need a lot of help in all those departments, you know, getting out of the way and telling the truth. Because I'm really clear today that my problem is that I am self-centered and selfish and egotistical. And those really are interchangeable terms. I'm just me. I'm always concerned about me and what you think of me, you know, and what kind of impression I'm making upon you. You know, and whether you like me or whether you think I'm funny looking or just all kinds of little self-centered things. And I'm going to tell you, to the best of my ability, what I was like before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, what happened when I got here, and what I'm like today. And it's been an interesting journey. And one of the first things you should know about me is I'm a scumbag. If you'd have seen me walking in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, you might have been politer than to say that, but that would have been the word that came to your head. Look at that scumbag. Anybody, they'll just let anybody in here, won't they? And I wasn't always a scumbag, but I came from a good family. I really did. I came from a very good family. It's an alcoholic family, like several other people have said this weekend. But I really related to Sissy's story a lot. There wasn't active alcoholism in my house all the time. It was kind of come and go. But my mom's is a full force Al-Anon, always has been. And in my family, there's three categories of people. There's people who are immensely successful. There's people who die of alcoholism, and there's a ton of Al-Anon women. And on both sides, going back, it's just a mess. But there's a ton of love. There's a ton of idealistic love, you know, in the family going on in every direction. And it's I wouldn't change my family. I wouldn't change my childhood. I wouldn't change any of the things that ever happened. And really, my little branch of the family was immensely successful financially. I say sometimes that my story is really the story of a guy who was born on third base. and just started running backwards around the bases. You know, if I'd have just had enough willpower or whatever to just shut up and show up and do whatever. That's one of my dad's very closest friends. They started this big company together, and the son of that friend, so this is the son of my dad's friend, told me one time when I was about 16, and I was desperately trying to light a joint on a moving boat, and I couldn't get it lit, and I was cursing because I hadn't had any intoxicants of any description for about 5 days as we'd been on this boat trip, and he was just looking at me, and he said, "Man, if you just went along with what your parents wanted for you, you'd be driving a convertible BMW to school every day. You could be," and this is a guy who inherited all his parents' money and spends his leisure time racing BMWs in the private circuit. You know, the rich kids who race BMWs for a living, and they build them, and they have their own garages and all that. That's the kind of person this guy is, you know, and he's a really good guy, really nice guy. He just has this incredible life. But I couldn't do that. I didn't have the power to do that, you know, and we're going to talk about that in my story. Lack of power is my dilemma, right? There's a lot of things that need to happen for this guy, and I don't have the power to make any of those things happen. And I didn't understand that. And I want to say, too, a lot of times when we talk and when I talk in AA, I'm talking from a place looking back. My sobriety date, by the way, I should have said from the beginning, is March 7th of 1989. So for the mathematically challenged, that's a little over 25 years ago. And I was not as clear then as I am now about what my problem was and what was wrong with me. When I was a kid, I knew that I was funny looking. I knew. I used to look in the mirror and just think, "Man, you are so funny looking." Self-centeredness takes on a lot of different facets, okay? But I mean, 8 or 9, looking in the mirror, just, "Man, you are funny looking." I had this really I do not have a receding hairline, okay? This big old forehead I've always had, and it's funny looking. My nose is funny looking, and my ears stick out just a little bit funny, and self-consciousness, that's one facet of self-centeredness, right? Self-conscious, and I'm always paranoid that I look funny, and I always knew that people didn't like me. They just didn't. They just didn't like me, didn't care for me, and so I always tried extra hard to make everybody like me. Which we've all met people like that, you know, someone who's disingenuous and obviously phony and trying to like suck up to you and make you like them. You don't like those people, so it becomes a self-fulfilling thing, you know. So I was just, you know, and every alcoholic I've ever heard basically said the same thing. I grew up and I was just disconnected, you know. I didn't fit. I didn't feel right. I didn't look right. I couldn't act right. I was in trouble a lot. always in trouble. Class clown. Goofy guy, you know. There were lots of meetings. There were lots of meetings of various people who were in charge at different places, church, school, you know, summer camp, wherever. What we're going to do about John? What are we going to do? What are we going to do about John? Those meetings would continue basically forever until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And somewhere along the line in there, like I said, I come from a big, boisterous drinking family. They're big, they're wild, they're southern, they're crazy, and they drank a lot. And so I drank, I can't tell you when my first sip off a beer was, you know. I do remember when I was about 8 years old, and I never drank enough to get drunk at 8 years old, but there was a Super Bowl party at my house, and one of my older brothers, I have 5 older half-brothers and sisters and a couple of younger brothers, big, crazy family. And someone had a beer, and I said, "Hey, can I have a sip of your beer? You know, Brother Ben?" And yeah, sure, you can have a sip of my beer. And somehow I just knew that you were supposed to do this. And I turned that beer up, and I drank, you know, 2 or 3 big, huge slugs off of it before he grabbed it and said, "That, you don't drink it like that." He's not an alcoholic. He's the sane one, actually. My brother Ben's the sane one in the family. I mean, that's weird to me that at 8 years old I had the idea that you're supposed to chug that, you know. But the first time I drank enough to feel it was I was about 13 and went out one night with some of the older boys in the neighborhood. And I was very nervous about going out. I knew we were going to be drinking, And I wanted to go out drinking, but these were guys I'm 13, these guys are 14, 15, and at least one of them was 16 because he had a car and was driving us around. And I was terrified that I was going to make a fool of myself in front of these older, more, you know, mature, urbane 14, 15, 16-year-olds. And so I wanted to be included, was afraid to be included, you know, just that torn in 10 directions all of my life, all the time. But we went out, and we got, the four of us got 8 quarts of Mickey's Mean Green Malt Liquor. And halfway, it was the most foul stuff I ever drank, for sure. I was slugging it down and going, man, that is good, you know. You know, inside just like retching. But I got through half of a quart. And the magic that happens to alcoholics just happened to me. All of a sudden, these were the very closest friends that a man could have, you know. I just was connected in a way that I'm truthfully, it's in the way that I'm connected to y'all today. You know, the way that 3 or 4 alcoholics who don't know each other can sit down over a cup of coffee and almost instantaneously have that connection and that camaraderie and that spirit, that godliness, you know, that I didn't know that that's what that was back in those days. But that's what it is. It's a spiritual connection, like Carl Jung told Bill. You know, spirits replacing spirits, you know, and that's our shortcut in alcoholics, is alcoholics, you know. But I was connected with those guys, and man, we just, you know, it was the first night I ever drank, seriously. Got drunk, drank 2 quarts, and all we did was drive around. So we're drunk driving the first night ever, you know, drunk driving, driving around Tampa. I grew up in Tampa, Florida, and smoking cigarettes and just cursing and yelling and screaming and driving fast and going, taking corners and laughing in the back seat. Ha, this is great. We're all going to die. And and that's all we did, was drink and drive all night. And then we ended up at a midnight movie, you know, and it was 48 hours with Eddie Murphy. I do remember that. And I was just so drunk. And I urinated on the floor of the theater during the movie just because I thought it would be a really cool thing to do, you know. That's scumbag, right? That's who you got up here. And which necessitated a hasty exit from the movie, and we had to jump up and run out of there because people were yelling and screaming, there's some idiot alcoholic in here peeing on the floor. And ended up back at my friend's place where I got sick, at my friend's mother's place. I mean, you know, we're teenagers, and threw up all over the place. Trouble, lots of trouble came of that. You know, everyone got in trouble, and I was the one who got everyone in trouble because I was the one who couldn't hold his liquor, blah, blah, blah. And so I was terribly sick, and I had gotten everybody in trouble, and I was in trouble, and I was grounded for a few weeks, and blah, blah, blah. And I estimated that to be the very best time I had ever had. I absolutely did. It was the very best time I had ever had. I didn't know it was possible to feel that good. I didn't know that I had been not feeling good, really. I mean, I think if you had caught up with me the day before and said, John, what's the overall quality of your life? I probably would have said, it's okay. You know, it's good, whatever. I don't think I was as conscious of what was wrong with me until I had that drink. And now I've been taken to this new level that I didn't even know existed until that point. And sobriety would never do again, as my wife is fond of saying. It just would never do. But I'm 13. You know, I can't be drinking and partying all the time. So, you know, it was a weekend thing, and we would... Thankfully, I lived in a neighborhood with a lot of other potential alcoholics, and you know, and so we would take turns stealing our parents' booze. You know, it was one of these deals where you'd get a jar, you know, and someone would distract the parents, and then someone would run into the pantry and get an inch off of this bottle, an inch off of that bottle, an inch off of that bottle, and I mean foul mixtures, you know, scotch and cream de menthe and peppermint brandy, and you know, I mean just and Jack Daniels and you know whatever, just and it would be. It'd be cloudy and, you know, oh, thanks very much. And it'd just be this awful thing. And it'd be in a jar, and we'd go out in the park. At night, we'd sneak out and stuff, or we'd all be spending the night out at someone else's house, and we'd be in the park and passing that jar around, and it was one of those, I'm going to pass it on, and we'd get wasted and just have a ball. And we used to run around in the bushes and stuff. That was big time. And, that's my social drinking. So, I'm one of those alcoholics that I'm real open-minded. Any kind of drugs or anything that you got that's going to make me feel good, enhance my alcoholic buzz, I'm all up for that. So I was one of them types. And pretty soon, you know, I'd smoking pot and popping pills and doing whatever and just running and crazy. And I got kicked out of school in the ninth grade. I went to the nice, ritzy college prep school that the doctors, my father's a doctor, and he's an inventor, and he's a self-made millionaire, and he's a Marine, and he's a real go-getter. Needless to say, he was not impressed. And I'll tell you, there's more to that story later, but I went to the ritzy prep school, Tampa Preparatory School. It's where all the doctors and lawyers' kids went. You know, the mayor's kid went there. And I went there, and I lasted there for 7 months before myself and four other students were all expelled one day over some antics that happened after a bunch of us had drank a bunch of beers and popped a bunch of pills at lunch, and one kid had a seizure and threw up, and then, you know, told everybody what happened, whatever, and we all got in trouble. It was his fault. And so I ended up at the local high school where I wanted to go in the first place. I didn't want to go to the ritzy prep school because they expect a lot more from you in a place like that. And, you know, a lot of my life actually is a story of being afraid of the expectations of what might be required of me in different situations, you know, and then running from that. So I ended up at the regular high school with all my degenerate friends, you know, which is where I wanted to be. And I love my degenerate friends. I'm still friends with some of those degenerate friends. One of them in particular, and he never did cross the line. He's one of those guys who, he got to a certain place in his life and he just sort of stopped or slowed down, and he got married and he works and he's doesn't have a lot of ambition, but you know, his ambition is basically to grow all his own pot. You know, that's his big ambition in life, and that seems to work for him. So, he knows where I am. He knows my story. So, if he ever wants it, he can come get it. But so, I'm in regular high school, my degenerate friends, and those were good years right there. In a lot of ways, they were just great years. I didn't have any expectations for myself, and I didn't care about the expectations that others had because I was drinking and partying day in and day out. And high school was a party. You know, I had this mother. I'll tell you about my Al-Anon mother. And it's a cautionary tale. In more than ways than one. My mother, my parents were divorced when I was 8 or 9, you know, and I don't remember having any big emotional harangue around that, you know. My dad was a, you know, maybe a workaholic, I don't know, but just a good provider and just a go-getter, and he just was out there inventing things and starting companies and, you know, and just being very successful. And they split up, and I live with my two younger brothers, and I live with my mother. And my mother is a nurse, like a lot of Al-Anons are. And isn't that true? A lot of Al-Anons are nurses, you know, love to take care of people. You know, my mom loves to take care of people. But she was a pretty shrewd woman and a wise woman. And she was she just had this ability. Like, if you came in the house and you were loaded, she could just look at you and say, you have drank 6 beers, smoked 2 joints, and taken 20 milligrams of Valium in the last 3 hours. And just be bang on. Just be exactly right. And so if you were, this is high school. I'm a teenager. I don't got any, I don't have any ability to stand on my own 2 feet. Or in life, I got to live by some kind of rules. And my mother had rules, and she, you know, she did a really good job raising the boys. And one of the rules was 6:30, you were home for dinner. And she was raising 3 boys on her own, and she was working full time, and she got home in time to cook a real dinner every single night. And it was on the table at 6:30, and by God, you'd better be there for dinner. And 6:30 is dinner, and you had to be at least 3 hours sober at 6:30 for dinner if you didn't want to catch hell. So 6:30, that's 3 hours. Now you can do some math here. If you have to be home and sober at 6:30, and that sober means 3 hours with no intoxicants of any description, that means the last drink you can take is at 3:30. School doesn't get out till 3:45. So, no problem, right? Not for an alcoholic. So I learned how to like get loaded all day at school. Starting at 7 in the morning. School didn't start till 8:15. But we got to school at 7. Me and my friends, we went down the street to the golf course. And there was a little wooded area in there. There was some woods inside of the golf course. And over the course of my high school career, that little wooded area just turned into a refuse of empty beer bottles and little baggies and just, you know, alcoholic refuse, and, you know, because that's where we hung out every day before school and got loaded. Needless to say, I didn't do real well in high school. And during my second junior year, I decided to quit. My wife laughed at me a lot when we first got married. We were first learning each other's stories. Because every year after high school, I went to summer school to make up stuff and summer night school. And she didn't even know there was such a thing as summer night school. And there looks like there's a lot of good students in here. Probably didn't know that either. Yeah. If you missed enough credits, you had to go to summer school. And if you couldn't make up enough credits in summer school, you had to go to summer night school. So I was all year round. I was a good student because I was in school all year round. Anyway, I quit one day just over, you know, alcoholics make really big decisions like that. And that's one day I just told the dean, I don't need your damn school. You know, kind of hanging just to look cool in front of some of my degenerate friends where they were all standing there in the background. I don't need your damn school. I was so cool. And so he said, good, let's go sign those papers right now. And he did. He drugged me right down to the office, put those papers down there, and I signed them. So this was the point at which my father became supremely impressed with me. He kicked me out. No son of mine. And I went to live with my mother, who, good Al-Anon, untreated Al-Anon that she was, took me right back in. And I just sponged off her for the next year. And at the end of the year, she did me this really supreme, this supremely just generous thing. She said, look, this is her last effort at trying to get me straightened out. She said, I'm going to move you into an apartment in Gainesville, Florida, about 2 hours north of where I lived. I'm going to get you enrolled at the junior college up there. And I'm going to get you a little car. And you're going to get out in the world and you're going to try to make something of yourself. And I just viewed this as real interference in my personal affairs. I mean, I had a perfectly good situation living in the room that I grew up in her home, where I could drink and drug and party all I wanted. And, it was ideal. Anyway, so she did this very generous thing for me, and she got me moved up to Gainesville, Florida, got me moved in this little apartment. She said she would help me pay rent and stuff, you know, whatever. And I got a little job up there delivering pizzas and started into school. And the whole time I knew it was just a matter of, exerting myself. I was going to recover. I was not going to be the scumbag that everybody thought I was going to turn out to be. So I enrolled in Santa Fe Junior College, started working at Pizza Pronto. Lovely little chain. And I just pretty much went about my business. Now, I didn't realize at this point that I'm an alcoholic, okay? And for the first time, I really have no oversight whatsoever. And so there's not even any need to try to control anything. It's just let it all hang out, and that's totally what happened. So I just started whipping and riding, and 1 year is what it took. 1 year for this alcoholic to just come crashing down. So, and this is where it kind of ended. At the age of 19... I had moved out of that nice apartment. I don't know why, but I moved into a house with another alcoholic, and it was going to be a great deal, and I don't know why it was going to be a great deal, but it was going to be this great deal. And we moved into this little house in the outskirts of Gainesville, and the rent was $450 a month, this little three-bedroom house, and it was me and this other guy. You know, the big book talks about, at the end, we sought out sordid places and lower companionship, make us forget. Well, Steve was my lower companion, my roommate. See, because I dropped out after my second junior year, but Steve had dropped out in seventh grade. And he was just one of those grade A, uneducated, you know, jail-seeking, you know, Central Florida rednecks. I mean, there's just a special breed down there. And so Steve and I were in this place. And in February of 1989, the situation was this. We were 2 months behind in the rent, and we were fixing to be evicted. And there was no gas, water, electricity, or telephone in this house. And it was February. And, you know, even in Florida in February, it can get mighty cold. We didn't have any water, so I wasn't showering, you know. Occasionally, I would go up the street to a friend of mine's house, and I'd trade him some drugs or something for a shower. But that was like once a month. We had no water in the house, so the toilet wasn't functional. Right? You need water to make a toilet function. And we had all kinds of scumbag alcoholic trash in and out of that house all the time, you know, and people were using the toilet. And that meant the house smelled like you would expect the house to smell. The solution to that, which I personally thought was ingenious, was to steal water from the next door neighbor once a day. And I would go and at night and I would steal the hose from the next door neighbor and I'd run it across, you know, the fence up into the bathroom window and we'd fill the tank up and flush it once a day. And I did not see that as unmanageability. I have to tell you, this is maybe the funniest part of, you know, our big book talks about not being able to differentiate the true from the false. And it talks a lot about delusion. Okay, we don't really talk about denial in Alcoholics Anonymous, but we talk an awful lot about delusion in our literature. Okay, I thought, man, a lot of people would never have been able to figure that out. You know, a lot of people wouldn't be able to handle the rigors of the life that I have to handle, and I'm able to rise to the occasion and solve this really complicated problem. Awesome. You know. I mean, that's insane. But that's exactly where my mind was at. That's where I was at. About that time, my mother had gotten into Al-Anon. Here's some more of that cautionary tale. My mother had gotten into Al-Anon, and she'd already put my two younger brothers, who were 17 at this time, into a rehab. They were still within her control, you know, so she could put them somewhere. I was 19. She couldn't put me anywhere. But she learned Al-Anonese. And she said to me on a phone call one day, "Well, honey, maybe you know, you could go to a place and just check it out and have an evaluation and just see if there was anything they could do for you." I remember this clear. So my mom was offering me a trip to treatment, and I was laying on my back, literally laying on my back with my feet propped on a wall, a dirty, dingy wall in this dirty, dingy front room of this house. And there was nothing, no utilities, just beer bottles and whiskey bottles and little baggies, empty baggies, and just paraphernalia and just rubbish and trash and pizza boxes. Just the pit of alcoholic despair that I went to. And I think, there's no way I'm an alcoholic. No, there's just no way I'm an alcoholic. I may be insane, though. That's what I thought. I really just honestly thought I may be insane. And maybe that place can help me with my mental problems. And I want to back up and tell you about my mental problems. When you are from, as I pointed out that I was, I'm from a wealthy family, basically, you know. The wealth was kind of just coming in waves at that time. My father had done really well for himself. And when that money started to come in, around the time my parents got divorced, it had started coming in. So they were just ridiculously wealthy. So anyway, when you come from a family of professional people who have money and you are a dumb, you know, an idiot, trying to edit myself here, you get a lot of professional help, okay? And I've been seeing shrinks and psychiatrists and counselors since I was 9, okay, me and my brothers. And I've been through all that and all that. And when I got kicked out of that ritzy prep school that I told you about earlier, there was another trip back to the shrink. And I saw at that time a man, a psychiatrist, who had been the president of the American Psychological Society. I'm not sure what the exact letters of that are, but anyway, you could look him up. He's in Wikipedia. I've looked him up since I got sober. And a very learned, very wise, very educated, professional man. And I did this 6-month psychological battery with that man. You know, I met him every 2 weeks for 3 hours, and we did the test with the ink blots, and then the test where you see a picture and you draw a story, you tell a story about what's that picture, and the entire psychological battery that can be done on a person. And at the end of that, I had a meeting with him and my parents and my step parents. We all sat in his office, and my mother said to this man point blank, "Is this kid an alcoholic?" And she knew I was an alcoholic, but the doctor said, "Nope. this guy does not have the mind of an alcoholic or the personality of an alcoholic. I could have kissed that man. I could have hugged him for the prescriptions, right? Thank God. And he said, he diagnosed me with this condition. Mixed cerebral dominance. It sounds good, doesn't it? It sounds real good. It is a valid condition. I've looked it up too. And it's a condition where mostly people who have it have pretty severe dyslexia, which I do not have. But it's a condition where neither your left hemisphere of your brain or your right hemisphere of your brain is predominating. Most people are left-brained or right-brained or something like that. And, you know, people with this condition are kind of back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, which, you know, there are reasons to believe that might be the case. However that might be. And I want to just say this. I don't want to, we joke a lot about the professional community and the alcoholics and how so many of us have not been able to find a solution there. I don't want to impugn anybody's career or the professional community in any way. There are people among us who have valid mental illnesses and who might need to seek outside help. But there are also people among us, like me, who are just dying to have any reason possible that I'm not the problem, that there's a condition that's the problem. It's not that I'm sorry, right? Because basically, let's just be honest. I mean, selfishness and self-centeredness, if that's the root of my problems, you might as well say sorriness is the root of my problems. And I will do anything not to have it be that I am just sorry, you know? And it turns out, in my case, I am sorry, and that is my problem, okay? But mixed cerebral dominance sounds a lot better than sorry. And so I just love that man. I related to you so much, Rick, when you said that. I just love that man. First of all, I'm not an alcoholic. And second of all, I have this condition. And that explains why I'm sorry. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous for my first year or two around, I let it be known to anybody who would listen about this. And this is why it was so great, too. Because, first of all, it's a really rare condition. Second of all, there's no known treatment for it. Isn't that great? So I would tell everybody who listened that I had a rare, untreatable mental illness in addition to alcoholism, and therefore it was going to be an awful lot harder for me than it was for you. And, you know, you get pity in certain quarters. You don't get pity in the stronger groups of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I avoided the stronger groups of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to the groups where you did get pity. And I hung out among the people where you did get pity for that kind of stuff. And that's kind of the story of, you know. But anyway, I took my mother up on this offer. I went to rehab. And let's see how we're doing here. And I started my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the miracles of AA happened really soon for me. I mean, I was just in treatment. I was, you know, I was coming off. I was doing a lot of drugs, a lot of drinking, a lot of booze, taking anything I could get my hands on. I was a big psychedelics guy. You know, I used to like to see things that weren't there. I just thought that was amazing. Anyway, so I'm coming off all that. I'm pretty loopy. But they had speakers come in, do exactly what I'm doing, told their story in the rehab, and you said it the other night. Everyone I related to, man or woman, black or white, didn't matter. I just related to all these folks so well. And the miracle, after about a month, I just said, these are my people. These are my people, and I love them. Now, it didn't mean that I wanted to do everything y'all were offering. It just means I just thought you were my people. And like I said, I didn't go to the big book groups, and I didn't go to the literature-based groups, and I didn't go to groups that pushed strong sponsorship, and I didn't do an awful lot of what y'all suggested in AA. And I know what it is like to be sober a few years and to have absolutely untreated alcoholism and to be insane. And that's my story. But I did. I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was delusional still. So one of those delusions is, because I love AA, and because I go to AA 7 times a week, I am a good AA member. And that's not necessarily true. My first 3 years in AA, I got to tell you a little bit more of that scumbag thing. And I came into AA and I was about 250 pounds. I weigh about 230 pounds today, and I've been woohoo back and forth in that whole deal. But 250 pounds of just alcoholic weight. You know what I'm saying? Like just beer and booze weight and pizza and cheeseburger weight. You know, and all I wore was black sweats and black heavy metal t-shirts. And I had long hair and it was parted kind of in the middle and it came down like this. And it was, you know, long. And that was when the scumbag idea would, I think, jump into people's minds. Because it wasn't combed or washed either. And so after 6 months of eating reasonably and 9 months maybe, and I started, you know, hanging out and doing things with people in AA, like play tennis, you know, weird stuff, play softball, play volleyball on the weekends. We'd do all these things together. We'd go out and do things. And I started to, like, lose a little weight and get in shape, and I bought a pair of jeans and a button-down shirt and got my hair cut. And all of a sudden, for the very first time in my life, girls were moderately interested. Now, the kind of girls that were interested were, you know, the kind of girls you would expect to be interested. Two flakes make a blizzard, you know? And, yeah, man. And so that was my new thing. I had never had any, jumping ahead a little. Fear has always been a big problem for me. And I didn't recognize it as fear until I got with a competent sponsor and got through this big book and started writing some inventory. But fear has been eating my lunch all of my life. And I was terrified of women from as long as I can remember. I didn't date or have much to do with women when I was drinking, you know, in those teenage years. And when men are mostly real interested in women, I wasn't. I was only interested in drinking. I mean, I just did not care. You women scared the hell out of me. You know, I didn't know what to do if I got one. And I was afraid I wouldn't get one. I'd get rejected. It was just a big old mess. So all of a sudden, I'm sober and I'm chasing the girls. And some of those girls will let you catch them. And so I'm chasing girls and I'm going to 7 meetings a week. And now I want you to understand, I'm convinced that I have a killer program. You know, I've got girl and I've got, meetings. And on the outside, God's honest truth is, just physical sobriety will get you a few things. You know, when a cop is behind you in traffic and you have physical sobriety and you have a driver's license and you have an insurance, you know, and you have a job. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, you're not freaking out like you used to. You're not having to look in the ashtray and hide stuff and all that. You know, physical sobriety in those first few years and just going to meetings. It is really good advice for the brand new person, right? Don't drink, go to meetings. Call me every day. Man, if you can do that in your first few weeks in Alcoholics Anonymous, you will benefit from doing that. It's not a good long-term program to just not drink, go to meetings, I don't believe. You know, there's other stuff eventually we have to do in here. I got to get a spiritual connection. And the only way to do that I've ever found is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That clears up the wreck inside me that allows the spirit to connect with me so that I have something to offer. And then in the process of offering it, man, I get even more connected. That's where the good dope actually is in Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, but I hadn't discovered any of that yet. So my program is 7 meetings a week. Tons of coffee, tons of cigarettes, tons of late night playing spades and poker. You know, we went to conferences. I was 19 years old when I got sober, folks. We went to the young people's conferences. We'd go to the young people's conferences in Alabama. We'd go to the young people's conferences in Florida and, you know, South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia. I was on the host committee for the 1994 International Convention of Young People in Atlanta. Just, you know, wah, wah, wah. That was basically my level of sobriety. It was just wah, you know. I was a cheerleader for Alcoholics Anonymous. I related a lot to Tracy. I think she was kind of a similar person. I was a big-time cheerleader for AA, and my delusion was I wasn't doing AA other than just the little barest bit of it, you know? I mean, the meetings are important in Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's 23 hours in a day for this alcoholic to get through besides that hour that I'm in the meeting. And if I don't have a program of action, those 23 hours will drag out, and I'll kill myself or somebody else eventually. And that's basically where I got. After 3 years, basically, in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had sponsors, okay, in those 3 years, in name only. I had a sponsor because people would ask you. They will, you know, especially in the stronger groups. And they say, do you have a sponsor? Or in my case, do you have a sponsor? You know, that's, they would say that. I got that a lot. Anyway, eventually, at 3 years, I almost got drunk at 3 years sober. And I was at that time, I was going to 7 meetings a week. On the outside, my life was as good as it had ever been. It was better than it had ever been. I went from a high school dropout scumbag to a clean-cut young man going to Emory University, had a car of that model year, okay, which was a novelty, had a girlfriend or two, had a nice little apartment, a little one-bedroom apartment in Midtown down there near Emory, you know, and just had clothes, had a job, was... My parents were proud of me for the first time in my life, which felt good. That'll keep you sober for a minute. You know, it does feel good when your parents are actually like, I'm so proud of you, son. You know? And there's a line in our book, and it says that the alcoholic is the victim of a delusion. One more delusion. That I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of life by managing well. And I was absolutely a victim of that delusion at that time. I really thought that if I got my psychological, I was still very much in the whole psychological thing, too, trying to figure everything out, and I had the counselor, and I had the therapy, and I was doing all this. Psychotherapy was my thing, man. I knew I was going to have a breakthrough any second, and I was going to suddenly be like, I'm really, really well, you know. Never happened for me. That's not to impugn anybody else's experience. Anyway, 3 years sober with all of that great stuff going on, that delusion, you know, was not working. And I didn't realize I was in that delusion. I can't manage. I got everything just the way I thought it needed to look. And I was so depressed. 7 meetings a week and everything out of my... I shared in every one of those 7 meetings, by the way. Every single one I shared in. Step 7, oh yeah. Step 7, let me tell you about Step 9, let me tell you about amends. Arrogance and ego and insanity, and I'm delusional. I don't see it. I think I have a killer program. So I almost get drunk at 3 years sober at a party, at Emory University fraternity party that I have no business being at. You know, it's worse to have a little bit of knowledge of the big book, you know, almost than none, you know, because I had read the big book because, you know, you got to look like you know what you're talking about in these meetings. And that's 10 times more important to look like you know what you're talking about than to actually know what you're talking about, right? If you're a guy, I'm an image guy. I'm all about image. So there's that line in our book. It's around page 100 where it says, I can go anywhere on this earth that any man may go as long as I maintain fit spiritual condition. And I had told somebody that a week or so before I went to this party where I almost got drunk. See, I was the one who was, I was the only one who was assessing the fitness of my spiritual condition at that time. And sponsorship is so, so, so important. I have to be sponsorable today. At 25 years sober, I have to be sponsorable. I have to call my sponsor and say, here's the situation, what do you think? And we'll have a conversation about it and come up with some plan of action about what to do about it. And I got to sponsor a lot of guys too. Anyway, I almost got drunk and I came back to my home group at that time, which was the Skyland group in North Atlanta. And there were a lot of really great old timers in that group. And there was this one guy. And I didn't like this guy. And I didn't like him because everywhere he went, he carried a big book under his arm. I mean, everywhere. He went to the bathroom during the meeting. He got up from his chair, put his keys down, put the big book under his arm, went to the bathroom, you know. And that big book was dog-eared and marked up and highlighted and blah, blah, blah. Oh, my God. It was a badge of, you know, many big book studies. And I went up to him and I said, hey, man, I almost got drunk. I'm 3 years sober. I've never had a sponsor. I've never worked the steps. And I'm really miserable. And I don't know how I don't know how my ego got deflated enough for me to say that stuff. It's a miracle, is God's honest truth. And that started me and this guy, and it was really only briefly with him. Turns out he was insane. He was insane, but by comparison, he was doing a lot better than this guy. And I ended up with his sponsor after maybe 6 months or a year. And his sponsor was a very good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. His name is Dennis Sanfilippo, who died a few years, you know, 10 years ago now. And God rest his soul. He sponsored 1,000 guys over his sobriety. And that one of those kind of guys, you know. I had a big book study in his house every Wednesday for 25 years. And just a prodigy of service. And that started me on this journey. And in a very short, so when, you know, my first sponsor, a month into that sponsorship, I was doing a fifth step with him. And it was amazing. I'll talk about my dad just for a minute as it relates to it. So I told you, my dad's this amazing cat, right? I mean, my dad, he came out of an alcoholic family. He went to the Marine Corps, fought in Korea, GI Bill, college, medical school. By the time he was done with medical school, he had five kids already. You know, started a practice, started a career, invented things, made a bunch of money, started a company that's now got 600 employees that does a non-for-profit company. You know, just, I mean, one, just, I mean, as dynamic and as powerful a man as is, just an amazing character. I hated his guts. And all that nice stuff that I just got done telling you about him, I couldn't see any of that. That's the result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I resented him because he wasn't there for me, and he never came to my Little League games, and he was just this distant figure, and he was a lousy father, blah, 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 blah. So when I'm writing, I'm 3 years sober now. I'm writing this first inventory, and I'm writing this stuff out about my dad and how resentful I am towards him. And in column four of our resentment inventory is, where am I at fault in all of this? And it was blank. It was blank. And it was blank for a ton of stuff that I was resentful about. Because delusion means I can't see the truth. I need help sometimes. I need help sometimes. And I went over to my sponsor's house, sat down to go over this inventory, and I said, I column four, I don't got nothing. You know, and he said, well, what kind of a son were you? Man, that's a simple question. And it just opened the floodgates of perception that I wasn't seeing the world right, and I was a lousy son. I didn't even know. This is how self-centered I am. I didn't even know my father's birthday. I didn't know what day his birthday was. That's how self-centered I was. I didn't know. You know, my family's like, hey, here's a card for dad. Just sign it. You know, that's how much I cared. You know. Then there's a lot more to that story. But then started writing fear inventory. Like women. I'm terrified of women. Why are you afraid of women? You know, well, because they probably won't like me. You know, and if I ever get one, she'll probably leave. I'm afraid to get a woman, and I'm afraid to not get a woman. I just have fear. You know what I'm saying? And my fear eats my lunch and drives my decision making. And I put on an act, especially for women. I put on an act. I can't be myself. I put on an act. I got to be what I think you want me to be. I'm already two steps removed from reality right there. I'm going to act like I think you want me to act. Anyway, what I'm saying is, in the process of the steps, I started getting a whole new perspective on things. I didn't have a big problem with the God thing coming in here. I was happy to get on my knees and pray, and maybe that's the only reason I stayed sober for those 3 years, because I was praying every day, God, help me stay sober. But I started to have a real spiritual experience at this point, you know, and so I got through those steps, and I got up and started making amends to my family and started setting things right. I'll tell you something funny about my father. When I made amends to my father, I had been in treatment for 4.5 months. We did family day. We're talking about family week, family day and treatment, and it was just a disaster in my family. You know, my dad, we did it by, he was out of state, so we had to do it over the telephone, and I was just like, you SOB, you never gave me no love, and blah, 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 and you didn't come to my Little League games, SOB, blah, blah. And family counseling just didn't go very well in my family. But when I got around to making amends to my father, and I just said, Dad, I just want you to know I love you, and I was a lousy son, and I did this and this and this and this, and I would like to figure out a way to set it right with you. And he said, son, you don't need to do any of this. You're great. I was a lousy father, which is all I'd ever wanted him to say in damn therapy. You know, I'm in therapy trying to get him to tell what about lousy SOB he was. You know, and when I got over that and I just did what I think God wants me to do, is to stop being self-centered and worried about me and worried about trying to make things right for somebody else, suddenly, you know, anyway, I talked to my dad every single Sunday for the last 22 years. And every, you know, and for 20 of those years, he tells me he loves me, which he never had done. And my sponsor, one of the things he told me during this process was, you're going to call your dad every Sunday from now until you die or he dies, and you're going to say, Dad, how are you? I'm just calling to check in and see how you're doing. I just want you to know that I love you. And this was way before I started my amends. This was like just, you know, early on. And I've been doing that for 22 years. And after 3 years, he started saying, I love you too. And he's continued to say, I love you too. Now, sometimes he'll say it first, you know, which is really weird stuff that these kind of things happen. I'm going to start winding this up. Anyway, there's a lot more to tell about all of that. But so that was, I started really working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in earnest at 3 years sober. And that was 22 years ago. And I have earnestly been working it for the last 22 years. And my life is amazing. A scumbag like me should not have the life that I have. I met a little girl in Alcoholics Anonymous. After I'd worked the steps, it was real different. I had wrote out in my sexual inventory my sexual ideal. I wanted someone who was sober and sane and funny and intelligent and, you know, a whole bunch of other things besides. But they were spiritually, but there were principles about that stuff, the kind of person I wanted to end up. And my sponsor said, okay, you got to be those things. With God's help, if you can be those things, you'll attract that person. And Kathy and I have been married 18 years. And, yeah. And the longest relationship I had prior to, well, after working the steps, I dated a girl for 18 months. Prior to that, 18 days. So it's 18 days was the best I could do. Then it was 18 months after working the steps. And then when I found Kathy, now it's 18 years. That's really weird. I never thought about it just like that, but that's exactly how it is. We've been together for 20 years. Actually, we've married for 18. We lived in sin for a couple. I don't want to be too good. But we started on this journey together. I'm a weirdo. The truth is, I've always been a weirdo and eccentric. Eccentric's a nice term for weirdo. And I come from a long line of eccentrics and weirdos and drunks. And I always liked science. And when I went back to college in sobriety, I started at junior college and I ended up at Emory. And the only classes that I liked, I just knew I didn't want to wait tables no more and deliver pizzas no more. All right, that's all I knew when I went back to college. But the only classes I liked were science classes. So I kept taking more science classes, biology class and chemistry class and math class, and ended up with a degree in biology from Emory University. There's not a hell of a lot you can do with a degree in biology. You can teach, you know, and you might be able to be a technician in some company somewhere doing water sampling or something. There's not a lot. So I applied for graduate school. Anyway, to make a long story short, one day I was working in this tech job that I was working, waiting to hear, and I got a phone call from Yale University, and they said, hey, have you made a decision about where you're going to grad school yet? And I said, well, no. And I said, well, we want to offer you a slot. And I said, well, I have to tell you this. This is important, because Kathy and I, we live, the traditions run our household, okay? And there's a bunch of things that means. There's no time to go into it really in detail this morning, but one of the things is that there's an ultimate authority in our household, and it ain't me and it ain't her. And we don't make big decisions that affect the family, you know, without consulting the other one. So I said, you're going to have to wait. Well, I called my fiancée. She's my fiancée. Actually, she was a week away from being my fiancée. But we were already living together, had a joint checking account, because that's what our sponsors had told us to do. And we were following directions by this point. And so anyhow, I hung up and I called her and I said, hey, honey, Yale University just called and they've offered me a spot, but I didn't want to accept until I talked to you. And she goes, my God, you call them back right now. You tell them, yeah. high school dropout scumbag like me got to go to Yale University and work in a building where 30 Nobel Prizes had been sorted out. You know, none of them got sorted out by me while I was there. Amazing stuff. And we moved to Connecticut and met a few other people there, and we weren't real happy with the groups, and they weren't real happy with the groups, so we started a group up there with them. And everywhere we've moved, we've ended up starting a group. And it was a great group, and it's a really wonderful bunch of people. We made some really good friends up there in Connecticut. And after 3 years in Connecticut, through a complicated series of kind of things, we ended up in London, England for 4 years. Didn't like the groups over there. Started another group, and that group's still going. And made up some wonderful friends over there. We had one child while we were living in Connecticut, little boy Parker, who's 16 now. And a couple years later in London, weren't planning on it, but we had another little boy named Zach. who's they're both amazing children. And 4 years, I got my PhD in molecular biology. Came back to the States. On my office door, to this day, it says, John Shires, GED, PhD. And not one person, has ever said anything about that. I keep expecting somebody to say, what the hell is the deal with that, John? You know, either they're too embarrassed or they just don't pay any attention. I don't know. Anyway, got back here and bought a house and set it back in Atlanta. And we were glad to get home. And, you know, and Sissy, you were talking about this. And, you know, things, sometimes, you know, things are just, I mean, I'm a cheerleader still for Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the people. I love the program. I love the meetings. I love conventions. I love everything about it. And I just, God, through Alcoholics Anonymous, has just given me so much. But sometimes things come along and they knock you for a loop. And we were expecting our third child, and back in 2004, and my wife has late pregnancies. She was 2 weeks late. She's late everywhere, by the way. She'll tell you that, including her pregnancies. She's always 2 weeks late. And so we were late, and with this particular clinic, when you're late, they want you to come in after a week of being late and do an ultrasound and all that. And they did the ultrasound, and they said, there's some very severe brain abnormalities with your little baby. We're going to have to take her today. You go to the hospital right now. We got the whole surgery team set up to take this child. We're going to do C-section. We're going to get her in ICU, and we're going to see what we can do about it. So, you know, when you hear something like that, like Sissy was saying, you know, you just do what you're supposed to do, and you make phone calls. And it was actually funny. We got to the hospital, and my cell phone went off, and I answered it, and it was my sponsor's, my former sponsor's wife. And she said, John, how's it going? We're so excited. And I just started crying. I said, there's something wrong with the baby, and they're going to do C-section, and it's the brain, and it's serious, and I don't know what the hell to do. And that just started a chain reaction in Alcoholics Anonymous that ended up with 100 people showing up in different ways, shapes, and forms over the next few days to help us out. And our little girl was born, and she's good. She's good. She's a special needs child, and she presents a lot like an autistic child would, except that, you know, really, and some of y'all may have had experience with this here, really autistic people can't love you. My daughter can love you. She'll love the hell out of you. She'll come jump on your lap and hug you and tell you how much she loves you. But she does have some problems, but she has just been a joy in our life. And in that, one of possibly the worst thing you could tell an alcoholic is there's a lot of uncertainty. Alcoholics do really poorly in uncertainty. And the doctor told us, look, when she came home from the hospital after a week, he said, look, she's got a really serious brain injury. You know, she had a stroke is basically what happened in the womb, and nobody can tell us why. And she had a real serious brain injury. About 1/6 of one side of her brain is just gone in the back on the right side. And he said, you know, we're not going to know how badly this is going to affect her until she grows up. So you have a little baby that looks just perfect. And she coos and she's beautiful and all this, but you know there's going to be a lot of problems down the road. And I'm telling you, your faith can continue to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger as you do all this stuff. So we got through that. And our daughter is just awesome. And there's not one thing about her that we would change really today. She's just the most charming little thing. And a lot of times I'll be doing fifth steps at my house. I do them in my bedroom, and there's a little couch on one end, and we sit there, me and my guy, and we're going through. And sometimes there's some heavy stuff in the fifth step, and it's just it's amazing to me. When heavy stuff is being discussed, my little daughter, Kinsey, will just come barreling into the room, and she'll run over to this blubbering guy and just say, I just love you. It happens a lot. It really does. And it's a God thing. It's a God thing, you know. And there's about a million trillion God things like that. That have happened to us. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. A guy like me ought not to be able to have the life that he has today. I have a wonderful wife who's also my best friend. I got 3 amazing children. I got a home in the suburbs. I got all this stuff. I didn't want any of that stuff, even, when I got sober. You know, which just shows me I don't know what's good for me, and I never have. God knows what's good for me. And if I can get out of the way, there's all kind of good stuff coming. It's just, it's so hard for an egotistical guy like me to get out of the way. You know, it is just so hard. Anyway, I think I'm about out of time. I want to thank the committee for bringing me out here and including me with this incredible panel of speakers this weekend. I feel very honored and blessed to be here. And thank you guys all so much for listening. I love you.